an unprecedented comeback as Donald Trump returns to power.
From this moment on, America's decline is over.
What his inaugural address revealed about his plans and priorities.
He's intending to get as much as he can out there and to use the powers of the presidency to the max.
Today's Monday, January 20th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman. Fans cheered as now President Donald Trump's motorcade drove toward the U.S. Capitol for his inauguration.
I'm emotional because I think he's just going to make America great again. And I believe in him from day one. And I'm just so happy that he's the President of the United States. And I think great things are going to come in 4 years.
In his inaugural speech Monday, Trump called for a revolution of common sense.
We will move with purpose and speed to bring back hope, prosperity, safety, and peace for citizens of every race, religion, color, and creed. For American citizens, January 20th, 2025 is Liberation Day.
The swearing-in of the 47th President of the United States marked his remarkable return to power since losing his second-term bid to Joe Biden in 2020.
The golden age of America begins right now.
Donald Trump's inauguration completes a triumphant comeback for a political disruptor who survived two impeachment trials, a felony conviction, two assassination attempts, and an indictment for attempting to overturn his 2020 election loss.
Over the past 8 years, I have been tested and challenged more than any president in our 250-year history, and I've learned a lot along the way. The journey to reclaim our republic has not been an easy one, that I can tell you. Those who wish to stop our cause have tried to take my freedom, and indeed, to take my life. Just a few months ago, in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear. But I felt then, and believe even more so now, that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again.
Dignitaries from across Washington and around the world crammed into the U.S. Capitol Rotunda to watch the peaceful transfer of power.
You know, they moved the ceremony indoors. It's normally held on the west steps of the U.S. Capitol building. I was out there this morning talking to people who had come to Washington for the inauguration. It didn't seem to me like it was the coldest inauguration I ever covered. But it's probably better to be safe than sorry. It was cold. It was cold.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were, I would have been a lot more comfortable inside, and people looked, it was interesting. It was actually more like, it seemed a little more intimate because there were so many less people than it normally is, or at least that's what it looked like from, you know, the television vantage point, for sure.
Well, no doubt there were fewer people inside the rotunda than the, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of people or 100,000 people that could have watched it outside. In fact, President Trump said that he thought maybe this is the way we ought to do it from now on. And having been out there in the freezing cold for an entire inauguration, I cannot say personally that he's not wrong. But let's see how this was different from other or the same as other inaugurations. Joining us now is historian Sean Wilentz, a professor of history at Princeton University.
Thanks very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure.
I guess just let's start off with, as a historian, you've seen and watched and probably taught about and dissected many inaugural speeches. Mm-hmm. What was your initial overview of the speech?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it was very different in many ways, and similar in one way. I mean, it's similar in that many inaugural addresses involve a kind of call to greatness, you know, that America is a great country, that we are can do many things, we are looking to a new order, so that's very common. But that's about the only thing that was common. Usually inaugural addresses are attempts to bring the country together, you know, after a very bitterly fought contest. Now we come back on common ground. There are certain things we all believe in, and that's that. That is the opposite of what I heard in the speech today, which was more like a rally speech as anything else. Talking about a little bit about wanting to be a uniter, but it wasn't really that at all. It was a campaign speech, and that's unusual. I mean, I hesitate to say it's unprecedented because historians never do, because they'll always find some example somewhere. But it's pretty unprecedented to be so obviously partisan, and not just the president, but you know, it was even some of the invocations and so forth. It was the whole thing actually sounded a lot more like a coronation than like an inauguration to me.
It's also unusual to focus the speech on himself as opposed to, like you said, rallying the country to greatness.
Precisely. Exactly. I mean, look, what he said was that God had spared him so that he could lead the country. That's extraordinary. But it's all about him. You know, he can fix it. Only he can do it. Only now he has he is God's anointed in a way that a king would be God's anointed. And that struck me. That was the line in there that was most extraordinary, was to hear that one.
It's not like he's really looking to sort of transform the role of the U.S. on the world stage.
Yes, but I'm not clear what that is exactly. I mean, are we going to be the greatest nation in the world and all powerful? I'm not quite sure what that would even mean in the world as it exists today. I mean, there's the silly stuff, the sort of manifest destiny stuff in the speech, like the Gulf of America and so forth. I mean, really, that's just bluster. The Panama Canal thing is much more serious, but it's going to be curious to see how he handles that with a fellow nation in the Organization of American States. You know, and doing so against their will, and at the same time not be doing any new wars, as he says. I didn't know what it all amounted to. It is America first. But that again is more rhetorical, I think, than anything substantive. I mean, there are many grave questions around the world that we have to deal with, and saying that America's number one does not address, you know, what's going on in the Middle East or what's going on in Ukraine or what's going on with China. Maybe a little bit more of that. But still, there's a great deal that the United States has to deal with that, you know, can't be subsumed under this kind of, you know, as I say, sort of manifest destiny. America is is more exceptional now than it's ever been before, which is really quite a strange locution anyway. But I mean, I'm not sure what that means.
Well, the manifest destiny part too is interesting because, you know, there are two ways to look at manifest destiny. It's not looked upon nicely by a lot of people.
I mean, you're absolutely right. Also, his vision of American history was kind of cartoonish too. I mean, he rehearsed this. To him, American history is all about, you know, tough, rugged people taming a wilderness that where nobody exists and building a great republic out of it. Well, you know, there are no immigrants, there are no Indians, there are no lots of things that were part of American history. So yeah, I mean, no, manifest destiny, I think he's trying to spin it as a noble act of what America does, but I'm not sure that certainly the rest of the world won't accept it that way, and I think many Americans won't either.
I've been in Washington all day on the train, on the street with people who support him, who voted for him, who believe in him, and they are very, very happy, and they love it when he talks like this. And he knows it. He's really smart about that.
Well, absolutely. He has his following. He has his thing. They love every word that he says. No question about that. And that's a lot of people.
You know, he ran very heavily focused on immigration issues,
yes.
And apparently there are going to be a lot of executive orders He's going to, planning on signing in today and in the coming week. And a lot of them do have to do with immigration, including something he said pertaining to birthright citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that is in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Can an executive order override that?
No. An executive order cannot override the Constitution that he is just sworn to uphold and protect and defend. The Constitution trumps all of that. Now, it is quite true. The 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution includes birthright citizenship. It was coming at the time of Reconstruction. It was a way to ensure that the freed people, the formerly enslaved, were going to, you know, be full citizens. And if they were born here, they are citizens of the United States. But then it becomes, has a much larger meaning as well, is that anyone who's born here is automatically a citizen. He wants to undo that. How do you undo a constitutional amendment? You can't undo it by executive order, that's for sure.
But you can get it to court that way, can't you?
Exactly. And I mean the engine of this transformation that we're seeing is not even so much the White House as the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, I can imagine coming up with a decision, given the fact that the decisions that it made in the last session, I would not be surprised. I wouldn't put it past the current majority on the Supreme Court to rule that an originalist reading of the 14th Amendment precludes, that it was only intended for the ex-slaves, the formerly enslaved, and does not include anyone else, and that you could pass a law which excluded others. That's how it would happen, exactly.
But Tom,
they would put it out there, they get into court, and it gets kicked up to the Supremes.
Just to follow up on this, but, you know, all new presidents or incoming presidents make a lot of ambitious promises, but things don't move that fast normally, do they?
No. He is going to, however, use the powers of the presidency, which I think people don't understand. Presidency has a lot of powers. Ordinarily recognized, or not only exercised, rather, or exercised with restraint. But, for example, calling the situation on the border a national emergency, well, that gives the president a great deal of power. It gives him the power to send troops down to the border, for example. It empowers him to do a lot of things. And in terms of swiftness, you know, getting these orders out, it's kind of like shock and awe. I mean, he's intending to get as much as he can out there, and to use the powers of the presidency to the max.
Well, yeah, if you look at Reagan, for example, they carefully plotted, we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do this. It looks like he's doing everything all at once right on day one.
Well, a lot of it all on day one. I mean, there's certain stuff out there that he can't, by executive order, for example, you know, undo progressives' income tax. You know, they'll do that much more strategically. But he's going to get as much done as he can. Yeah. I mean, Project 2025 really is a roadmap for what is to come. And if you read it carefully, all these executive orders come as no surprise.
The fact that you had private citizens, very wealthy private citizens, sitting in front of senior members of Congress on stage at the inauguration is I don't ever remember anything like that.
Unprecedented. Could you imagine John D. Rockefeller up there, you know, when Coolidge was inaugurated or something? Or he wasn't inaugurated that way, but you know what I'm saying? No. But the difference is this. I mean, we've had times in American history where very, very wealthy people have exercised, you know, inordinate power, right? Inordinate power. Always some power, but inordinate power. Especially the not-so-golden age of the robber barons, right? You all know who the robber barons were. I mentioned one of them, Carnegie and so forth. But there are two big differences. One is they were robber barons. They wanted to make a lot of money, but they weren't oligarchs. They weren't interested in exercising political power directly. They might bribe their way to political power. They might use everything they could to obtain political power, have very close relations with various office holders, but not actually to hold power themselves. That's the difference between robber barons and oligarchs. These guys are oligarchs. They want to run the country, and they want to run it the way they think it should be run. That again, is unprecedented in American history.
The other thing is, not to pin it all on President Trump, because there are people, particularly in the Republican Party, who have been moving us towards a strong presidency since Nixon. More power and more power and more power concentrated in the White House, pulling it away from the Congress and away from the courts.
Absolutely. And by the way, it wasn't just that, you know, the Republicans who were doing this, the Democrats kind of, you know, connived in all of that as well to a certain extent, because they thought they could use the presidency for their ends. But there's no question the presidency now has far more power than it did than anything that the framers intended back in 1787. And that it's had, you know, there was a long period at the end of the 19th century where people were complaining that Congress had too much power, that, you know, we're in a state of congressional government. And it took Teddy Roosevelt to reassert the power of the presidency. But we're now a long way from where Teddy Roosevelt was, that's for sure.
All right. Well, we thank you very much for taking all of this time to talk to us. And we really appreciate your insights. Thanks for being with us.
It's been a delight, and you know, let's do it again sometime. I really enjoyed this.
That would be great.
That was Sean Wilentz, professor of history at Princeton University. You know, Scott, I always just like to watch and look at what people decide to wear and how they're dressed up, and it's just fun to people watch on.
Well, it's a big event.
Historic moments like this.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big event. Went very smoothly. We're off and running into the administration of the 47th President of the United States.
Well, you have been listening to The Issue from The Voice of America.
On behalf of everyone here at VOA, a lot of people who are out there in the cold with the people that came to see the inauguration, thank you so much for joining us.
Follow The Issue on X, Blue Sky, and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24 hours a day, check out our website at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
And I'm Lori London. We'll talk to you tomorrow.